This paper explores silk textiles across cultures as documents of socio-economic, political and cultural exchange during the age of transition from late antiquity to early medieval times. The study centres on silk textiles, which were favoured by rulers who embedded them with messages to symbolise their authority and power and the prestige of their empires. The paper draws upon the evidence of surviving silks, archaeological and visual evidence of loom types, and the documented uses to which the silks were put across cultures. The paper is divided into three parts, which respectively focus upon, first, the role of cultural exchange in the promotion of loom technology, second, the archaeological evidence for loom types, and thirdly, cross-currents in designs and weaves of surviving silks. The paper poses the question, what part did cultural exchange play in the development of loom technology across the early medieval world? The cultivation of raw silk and the manufacture of silks across cultures represented a high-risk and labour-intensive industry which required substantial injections of cash to act as financial backing. As such, wealthy rulers of empires were well placed to establish silk industries, to set up silk weaving factories, and then to create imperial monopolies over the silks they produced. The end purpose of such activity was to produce sumptuous silks to serve as ceremonial costumes for the rulers and their courtiers, to act as splendid palace furnishings, and to serve as gifts of honour to court dignitaries or to visiting diplomats. Across cultures, government was enacted on a public stage with rulers costumed in silks and semi-silks in order to stand out from their subjects. This was as much true of the Sasanian court, 224 to 651, as it was of the Byzantine, the Islamic, and the Chinese courts. Silks from right across the Silk Road to Byzantium were in transit by way of trade. The practice of diplomatic gift exchange from earliest times brought both trade silks and exclusively produced court silks to the fore. Numerous embassies passed between the Chinese and the Sasanian and the Byzantine courts in the 6th century. For example, the ruler of China sent to Sasanian ruler Khusro I a red, gold and lapis lazuli coloured silk cloth with portrait of the Chinese emperor ceremoniously robed and crowned in his throne room and with courtiers holding fly whisks. Following a spate of five Byzantine embassies to the Sasanian court between 547 and 567, the marriage of Mariam, daughter of the Byzantine Emperor Maurice, to the Sasanian ruler Khusro II, was sealed alongside the dispatch of Sasanian gifts of gold and pearls and 1,000 pieces of priceless, thick silk and gold brocade. These gifts reflected the splendour of the silk-clad Sasanian ruler and his court and proclaimed the wealth and prowess of its sovereign, following centuries of military rivalry between the Roman and Sasanian empires. Canepa, in his book, The Two Eyes of the Earth, drew parallels between the ritual environment of the Sasanian and the Roman courts in several ways. That is, in their similar appropriation of public space as base for ceremony and public enactment of government, and for communication of messages about their piety and their legitimacy to rule. Their grafting of imperial ritual practices onto important religious sites and monuments was designed to render the rulers a semi-divine or divinely appointed, and their promulgation of ruler and empire strongly depended upon artistic representations of themselves. Similar parallels might be drawn between Byzantine and Islamic rulers, for example, in their patronage of holy places with silks, in their conviction that they were the divine appointees of the respective gods, and in their common presentation of rich textiles embroidered with their names to holy sites. In practical terms, The exchange of foreign luxury goods between Islamic rulers was regular and prolific. For instance, the Safavid ruler of Khorasan sent to the Caliph Mutadid 1,000 pieces of Byzantine brocade. Ibn Abi al-Sa'd sent to the same Caliph further Byzantine brocades as well as furnishings from Armenia. The Christian secretary of the mother of the Caliph al-Mutawakki sent Christian food in Chinese dishes, and his favorite slave girl gifted him 20 Chinese saddles with musk, ambergris, and other scents. Exchange of silks between Byzantium and Islamic rulers was part of an ongoing diplomatic gift exchange centered about truces and the establishment of peace treaties, ransom of prisoners of war, and or payment of tribute. For example, the Byzantine Emperor Romanus I sent to the Caliph Arad bi Allah in 938 to secure a truce, a peace treaty and ransom of prisoners, 7 brocade spreads, one with eagles in 2 colours, another with floral designs in 3 colours, one with tricoloured stripes, one red foliage design, one with trees on a white ground, 2 with hunters and roundels on a white ground, 2 with crouching lions in yellow, 2 with eagles, and so on, a huge list. Such examples of silk exchanges between courts from Sasanian times onwards and across into the early medieval Byzantine and Islamic periods easily can be multiplied by the hundreds. But the point of importance here is that through this practice, precious foreign textiles were readily made available in great numbers and over centuries across courts and cultures, where they could, and in fact did, exert both technical and design influences. This is borne out by surviving silks, not least by a 10th century Central Asian lion silk, at San Sebastian's Maastricht. The Central Asian weavers found it very difficult to imitate the smooth outlines of the imperial Byzantine lions of contemporary date. On the Central Asian silk, there are changes to the proportions of head and body of the lion. There's marked stepping of outlines. This is in sharp contrast to the Byzantine contours. These stylistic differences observed reflect technical differences between Byzantine and Central Asian silk weaving workshop practices, both in the nature of the silk yarn, the setting up of the warps on the loom, and in the technique of weaving the piece. The relative degree of sophistication of the looms used, as well as the relative skill of the craftsmen involved, also is reflected. I go now to the archaeological evidence of loom types. Up until recent times, there was scant archaeological, visual or documented evidence as to the types of pattern looms in operation across the early medieval world. Extant silks point to the fact that there must have been an advanced pattern-producing system available for weaving pattern compound tabbies and twills, samites, of the Sasanian, Byzantine and Islamic worlds, such as the Joseph silk at Sens, Byzantine piece, scenes with the life of the Virgin in Riggisberg, or a fragment with the rear of a figure from a tomb in Halabiyeh Zenobia in Syria. The Sasanian silks found in graves in Antinoe in Egypt, or the early Byzantine and Islamic silks found in Akhmim. Theodotus Cyrus in Syria described the act of weaving in wool or silk as a gift from God, and his description includes details of how patterns were woven. He wrote, "If one wished to contemplate precisely each process, one would admire the craft very much. As the wool is cut short and cleaned in the water, it's first torn in pieces and separated into small parts, then the roll of wool becomes thread. Having done this, subsequently the wool worker takes and separates from the rest the clean wool, and that which are straight threads, and putting together the rest, makes weft for the warp. Then female hands take and spin the fine threads. After stretching some threads in order on the looms, they insert the weft. With the rods, they separate the warp, and they loosen some or tighten some attached threads, and the weft thread is then pushed across and beaten down so that they make the cloth. He continues, and who would admire how from the one colour of the underlying wool or silk threads, myriad images of various animals and human forms, some hunting and some praying, and pictures and trees and many other things are woven. This 5th century description of a pattern weaving device appears to refer to hand-manipulated rods, which could be used to raise the correct warps of passage of the weft. Becker, in 1987, explained this as one of the earliest stages he thought in the manipulation of the warp for the production of patterns by hand prior to the development of any pattern, separate pattern device on the draw loom. Becker saw this as a precursor also of true pattern shafts. Becker described true pattern shafts as two rods supplied with heddles with a central hole through which the warps had to be threaded so that they could be lifted in the correct order for the creation of the pattern. The pattern shafts today are lifted by means of cords over pulleys connected to handles and operated either by the weaver or by an assistant. Becker suggested that Sasanian weft-faced compound twill pattern silks, samites, might have been woven on this type of loom. Crowford suggested that weft-faced compound tabbies of contemporary date might have been woven on what she termed shaft draw looms with treadles. The loom could have had as many as 100 shafts, but the patterns produced would not have been very large. Becker tried to reweave a 3rd century silk from Syria on this type of loom using 7 shafts and 12 treadles. And that's the original, and that's the copy that he wove on that type of loom. Becker saw a 4th type of pattern producing device as being more advanced than the shaft draw loom. This is still found today, and the draw loom with cross harness device can be seen in India, used for weaving silk with complex patterns with even repeats across the silk. On this type of horizontal loom, strong cords are attached across the wall. To the centre of each cord, a drawstring is knotted and attached to the ceiling above the loom, and the drawstrings are weighted below the loom. Each cord across the warp has loops through which the correct warps for the production of the pattern pass. This allows for the automatic horizontal repeat of the design across the width of the fabric. Patterning lashes forming one repeat of the design are made separately and then knotted as a series onto the drawstrings. The weaver's drawboy is seated above the loom and he operates the drawstrings for the creation of the pattern using a V-shaped hook to lift the selected group of warps. An advanced historical Chinese draw loom, that's a pit loom. This is the advanced Chinese draw loom in a 13th century manuscript. Chinese scholars suggested that this form of loom existed in China earlier, in the 9th or 10th century under the late Tang and the Five Dynasties. The advantage of this type of advanced pattern draw loom operated by a weaver seated before the loom and by an assistant who manipulated the attached pattern producing device from a seated position high above the loom is that it had individually weighted cords. In 2012, the archaeological discovery, that is that complex Chinese draw loom recreated. In 2012, the archaeological discovery of 4 looms in a hand tomb in Chengdu in China was significant. It represents a loom used before the evolution of the advanced Chinese draw loom we've just looked at. It measures 50 by 70 by 20 centimetres. The four excavated Chinese looms were given the name of hook shaft pattern looms, and they came from a Han period grave, which the Han period ends in the 3rd century AD. In 2013, the National Museum of China reconstructed three full-sized hook-shaft pattern looms and rewove a hand-period inscribed pattern silk on one of them. That's the loom, and that's what they rewove. In the same museum, a 13th century Ming period Lampas weave silk was woven on an advanced draw loom, like that in the manuscript. And that is what they wove. The weaver there was seated in front of the loom and controlled the ground weave harnesses via treadles, whilst an assistant was seated above the loom and controlled the pattern harness with its attached pattern cords, which, when pulled by the assistant, raised the warp to form pattern sheds for the passage of the wefts in the production of the design. An advanced pattern draw loom of some type must have been available to the Imperial Byzantine weavers of the Moissac hunter silk of the 8th to 9th century, and even more to the weavers of the Arkhan elephant silk around the year 1000 AD. And I would favour it being a type of advanced draw loom like the Chinese draw loom. And that is what I suggested for this. And the medallions are over a metre wide. The number of manipulations of the pattern-producing device would have been 1,440. Some type of pattern draw loom has to be envisaged for the weaving of complex patterns. Also, for the Islamic elephant silk at St. Jos, which has a woven Islamic inscription bearing the name of Abu Mansur Bukhatin of Khorasan, who died in 961. It is known that in the 8th century, Chinese silk weavers were working for the Abbasid court in Baghdad. Did they bring with them knowledge of the working of the latest looms used in China? If so, did this influence the loom technology of the Islamic world in the 8th century? Whatever the answer to this question, by the 10th century, the Chinese would have been using the much more advanced multi-shaft pattern loom as well as advanced draw loom shown in the 12th century Chinese manuscript. At the same time, the Byzantine imperial weavers would have had a sophisticated pattern draw loom capable of weaving the Arkhan elephant silk. Zhao Feng has suggested that the loom used to weave 7th to 8th century Central Asian weft-faced twills or samets, they're in European church treasuries. To weave those, he suggested that a pattern device like this was used. It had heddles for the ground and a pattern device shown here, with cords and leashes attached to the warps for picking up the pattern. Working back from present-day traditional looms still used for hand-weaving in China, other historical Chinese loom types have been reconstructed. These include the early Han oblique treadle loom with two treadles, and that was found, the little pottery was found in the Han tomb. The Han period backstrap treadle loom, the Han period reconstructed so-called stepping stone loom with multi-shaft and multi-treadles for pattern weaving. Usually it had 2 to 8 depression shafts for weaving the ground and 40 to 60 lifting shafts for weaving the pattern. The vertical treadle loom, known from Dunhuang grotto depictions, dated to the 10th century. The Tang and Song dynasty period's Kesi tapestry weaving loom. A reconstructed Tang period damask weave loom. and a sophisticated loom presently used for weaving gauze in Hangzhou. From this it can be gathered that different looms were in use for different types of weaves in China at different times. Once the advanced pattern loom had been invented, it's likely that some specialised looms for particular weaves, such as gauzes, still were used. When examining extant historical silks, it's impossible to say whether or not they were woven on specific looms according to their weaving type, but the degree of and the skill of the weavers using that loom can be gauged. The appearance of weaving faults in the design best provide clues as to the accuracy of the tying in of the pattern across the warps, and their consistency across the silk may point to the use of an automatic pattern repeat device on the loom. Further, the use or lack of use of a reed to separate warps and the degree of sophistication of the pattern producing devices used may be reflected in the accurate or otherwise reproduction of horizontal and vertical repeats of the designs across the silk. In many cases, there seems to be a device for the horizontal repeat of the pattern, but not for the vertical repeat. I turn now to the cross currents and designs. Cross-cultural influences are especially visible in the designs of the silks. The astonishingly long-lived influence of motifs known from Sasanian carvings of Taki Bustan and other sites were felt on Byzantine, Islamic and Central Asian silks over centuries. The reason for this may lie in the special significance that the motifs held for the Sasanian rulers and the fact that they hark back to beliefs of pre-Sasanian times. These are drinking vessels which were in Mesopotamia from the 4th millennium BC. And they have the motifs which you later then find on the silks. So these vessels incorporated bull, ram, and goat forms, and these were all references or manifestation of the ancient Persian gods. Bahram Gur, the god of gods, was the god of war and of warriors. He was represented by the bull. The bull, too, represented the source of headwaters, guardian of the land and symbol of eternity, fertility, healing, and wisdom. Mithra was goddess of victory, and the king performed ritual dances to her, and she was represented by the symbol of the winged lion. By drinking from her cup, the king asked for her support in victory. The ancient lion and winged bull symbols, especially later, were used by the Sasanians to represent Mithra, and they symbolized peace and alliance. The eagle, griffin, and phoenix were ancient symbolic representations related to the Persian gods, and these motifs appear on later silks across cultures too. And some of these were also symbols in the Hellenic tradition. It is astounding just how many of these ancient Iranian motifs found a way into silk weaving across cultures. For example, in the 8th to 9th century, the Byzantine Maastricht Dioscurides silk We've got one missing, but never mind, we'll go on. Anyway, this silk, this Byzantine silk, showed a Mithraic bull sacrifice. And it may have been that in the iconoclastic period, they wanted to draw attention to the dangers of worshipping pagan gods. Classically based motifs, such as Amazons, were woven by both Byzantine and Islamic workshops, with and without inscriptions. The Sasanian flying ribbons are combined with a motif of the classical Pegasus motif on an 8th to 9th century Byzantine silk from the Vatican. Central Asian silks of the 7th to 9th centuries and contemporary Chinese silks present lion, ram, bull and horned ibex motifs, some bear ribbons. There also appear ducks, again known to have been symbolic Mesopotamian motifs. All of these reflect earlier Iranian influences, and some were actually excavated in China. On the other hand, Eastern Mediterranean workshops of the 7th to 8th and 8th to 9th century exported classically sourced hunter scenes to Central Asia. This is a Central Asian piece which is in the British Museum. There, weavers find the motifs difficult to reproduce because of their use of finely graduated motif contours. Conversely, Byzantine weavers were portraying hunter scenes inspired by the legend of Bahram Gur. Finally, the unique contribution of the Islamic courts, the production of tiras, which may have been inspired by reports of Sasanian silks of portraits of rulers, should be mentioned. Tiras were non-figural, inscribed and decorated cloths, which symbolized the word of God sent down to Muhammad and recorded in the Quran. The name signified a textile with woven inscription, many of which included Quranic references to God. Tiras were woven earliest in court-regulated tiras factories under the Umayyads of Syria. Tiras is first documented under Hisham, 724-703, but the location of tiras factories under the Umayyads, the Abbasids and the Fatimids is far from clear, although they certainly existed in Egypt, Syria and Spain. And we see the two earliest surviving fabrics. Bear the name of Marwan, by most scholars thought to refer to Caliph Marwan II, 744-750. Only one of these two pieces is a silk, and this is the piece. It's a twill, a samite, and it bears an embroidered inscription with the name of the Caliph, the name of the weaver, the place of manufacture, thought to refer to Tunisia. The second piece of interest is the Hisham tiras. And that comes from Spain. And Hisham II's dates were 976 to 1013, came from the Church of the Virgin in Soria, Spain. The textile uses silk, gold, and linen thread, and is woven in tabi with inwoven tapestry inscription and decorative band enclosing animals and bird motifs. The inscription names the Caliph and includes blessings from God upon him. A somewhat later tiras of plain gossamer thin linen in tabi weave with silk and gold tapestry, survives in the form of a whole vestment. This was woven, according to the inscription, under the Fatimid Caliph al-Musta, 1094-1102, in a private diras in Damietta in 1096-1097. It was a great honour for different caliphs to weave in their royal tiras factory and to send the curtains for the draping of the Kaab, the Kiswa, each year. The tiras factory of Tinis under the Abbasid Caliph, for example, produced the hangings for the Kaab in 776 AD. The royal tiras factories were strictly controlled and supervised, and the quality of the woven textiles was scrutinized minutely, especially when gold thread was involved. The director of royal tiras factories was a high court official with special quarters, under whose guidance great sums of money were spent in the manufacture of the royal tiras. Specialised, highly paid weavers carried out the work, and special ceremonies marked the completion of tiras pieces and also their reception by the caliphs. As such, the royal tiras factories were comparable as institutions to the Byzantine imperial silk weaving factories, which also were closely supervised. The silk produced across cultures also acted as a currency equivalent to gold, and taxes were paid in silk in China and across the Islamic lands, while in Byzantium, silk was used to part pay the wages of the imperial defence forces. In conclusion, the earliest surviving silks across the cultures discussed were woven in common specific weaves, tabi, twill, tapestry, and later lampas. From the 7th to 8th to 9th to 10th century in Byzantine, Islamic and Central Asian workshops, weavers adopted, adapted and integrated each other's motifs, and there was a long-lived Sasanian influence in this regard. The degree of complexity and the size of motifs in common across cultures increased from the 10th to the 11th century. All this suggests that weavers across cultures were familiar with each other's weaving traditions, both stylistic and technological. Also, the capture and the forced movement of skilled weavers across courts gave increased impetus to skilled technological transfer. Rulers across cultures both received foreign silks through the practice of politically motivated silk gift exchange, and within each individual culture sent gifts, including foreign silks. Thus, Chinese, Sasanian, Byzantine and Islamic courts were very familiar with the concept of silk as symbol of power and authority across cultures. Through individual ceremonial and ritual practices often exercised inside of visiting embassies, the courts in common used to communicate the stability of their empires. Silk was used to symbolize the establishment of good government, powerful, pious, and legitimate rule. Courtly silk patronage in the form of donation to holy places or gifts of robes of honour in common served to unite the ruler and the ruled across cultures, whilst acting as a visible sign of the worldly wealth of the ruler. In answer to the question posed at the beginning of the paper, therefore, the evidence projects here perhaps suggests that there was a strong correlation between courtly cultural exchange and technological advancement in the field of silk weaving across the medieval world. Thank you.